Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunked. Today we have a special guest with us, Jim Davidson. And I'll give you a little intro here for those of you that aren't familiar with Jim's work. He is the founder of the Individual Sovereign University team. And we're going to actually cover a lot of that in the show today. And maybe a few other things. But here's the little intro that I can get for some of you that are not familiar with Jim's stuff. Founder, author, entrepreneur, and multinational multimillionaire Jim Davidson is founder of the Individual Sovereign University. His business enterprises have donated the seed capital for the planning and development phase of the university. Additional capital, including some matching funds, are being provided for building and growth phases. Davidson has been an entrepreneur since age 8 in enterprises such as recycling, urban light metals, lawn care, pool care, newspaper distribution, banking, aerospace, space tourism, healthcare, consulting, business planning, software development, real estate, toll road development, free port development, free market money, and private stock markets. Davidson is a world traveler and public speaker. His first book, The Atlantis Papers, was published by After Dark Publications in 1994. It details a constitution for a new country. His second book, Being Sovereign, is currently available from major retailers. A third book, Sovereign Self-Defense, is in progress and is to be made available in print and for Kindle. His fourth book is also being planned, Being Libertarian, and will compile all his essays from the Libertarian Enterprise since 1995. It is to be available in print and as a free PDF. Jim, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, yeah, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. I think it's a really exciting thing to penetrate into the second realm.
Yeah, we've had some pretty interesting guests, and the feedback that I've been getting from quite a few people, not masses of people, but quite a few people has been very encouraging, and I know that the show has meant a lot to me personally, and I think that this is our 17th show, so things are moving along here. Quite a little archive that is getting built up here. Recently, we've done mostly technical shows, and we've had a few non-technical shows. Today, I would like to hear from you and about this individual sovereign university you have going on, and then maybe we can cover a couple other topics like agorism. And I know you've been in contact with J. Neil Schulman and some other things. Well, you have some fascinating projects that you've been involved with in the past too. So we'll just see where we go from here. Why don't you tell us, our listeners, what is this individual sovereign university?
Well, the idea of the founding of a university is something that's been very important to me for a long time. I first got interested in it back in 1993. As a space activist, I was interested in the idea of a very long-term institution that could oversee the human exploration of the solar system and maybe out until the time when we began to visit nearby stars. And at the time, I was looking at the historical context of all that exploration that had gone on from Europe, starting about the, let's say, 13th and 14th centuries, and including all of the age of reconnaissance and the scramble for Africa and all this other stuff. And it occurred to me that this took place over hundreds and hundreds of years, and that if one were going to look at human institutions, hundreds of years is not typical for human institutions. People talk about governments, but they're really not that old. Even monarchies, every time a new monarch sits, many of the policies change. So you really don't get that much of a longevity from a single government. You look at companies, and they come and go. They go out of business. You look at all sorts of other institutions, and you get down to basically two kinds. Institutions of higher learning, such as universities, some go back. We think the University of Bologna might have been founded about 8980, so about 1,000 years for universities. And then you have religions, organized religions, like the Catholic Church, probably goes back to about 8383. Islam goes back, since about 600 AD. And Taoism goes back to maybe 400 BC or earlier, depending upon what years you want to assign to Lao Tse. So, then you have to ask the question, do I have the balls to found a religion? And I think I probably do, but I don't really have the, I can't really convey the sincerity for that long, And that's what people want out of religion. They want to sincerely believe that you believe. Uh-huh. And I don't think I can get that across. I don't think my acting skills are up to that. So I said, let's throw the university on the fire and see whether anything cooks. And so we founded the Houston Space Institute, and we spent a lot of time working with that, putting together a library and getting a team together to support it. And now more recently, about 2 years ago, we began looking at agorism as the path forward and as the way of moving towards a free society.
Right.
And again, I began thinking about, Lao Tse proposed these basic ideas a very long time ago.
Uh-huh.
He said, in the Tao Te Ching, he says that, if you look at the way people are, more laws doesn't make you more orderly. If you increase the number of laws, you get more criminals, and that's not good. And he looked at all of the power structures of the state and said, people are going to be attracted to that. A certain kind of person is attracted to that kind of power, that kind of coercion and brutality, and always will be. And so if we're going to survive the end of the state, if we're going to find a way around that, we're going to have to create a very long-term institution. Because he was talking 2,400 years ago, and there was a state of sorts in his time. And what he proposed was to withdraw. He said, reduce the amount of things that you want, withdraw from the cities, move up into the hills, get away from these people who want these things, and try to live your own life, separate and apart, and not engaged in, not contributing to the system.
Right.
And so there's a very long-standing tradition.
How long ago was this?
2,400 years ago,
okay.
400 BC, maybe 600 BC. This is the foundation, though, of the concept of Zamaya, which is a cultural thing in the highlands of Asia. Zomia is has recently been talked about by I don't know what they call themselves, philosophers, ethnographers, archaeologists, whatever, people who study American people who study human cultures have, come up with this term, Zomaya, to describe the people in the hills of Asia. And a lot of those are separate cultures. They're highly independent people, and they avoid the central state like the plague. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to have wars on their territory. They just want to withdraw. Mm-hmm. And they get further and further up into the mountains as their method of getting away from the state. So we looked at that, and we thought, well, 2,400 years is a long time. Do we want to found a religion that worked for, Taoism? But again, we have the same problem. Who's going to carry it off? Who's going to bring off that idea? So again, we founded the Individual Sovereign University in 2009 on the strength of the idea that agorism would take a while to take hold, that the state would take a while to die. Mm-hmm. That if you looked at things like Magna Carta 800 years ago, and other traditions of limiting the government and trying to, chain it down so the beast doesn't get away, none of that's really worked, right? I mean, if you look at England, it is not anarchy in the UK is an idea, but it's not, very thriving. And 800 years is a fucking long time. So, pardon my French, but it's, 800 years since Magna Carta was first signed. There's no evidence that the government in England has been chained. Mm-hmm. It slipped its bounds. You can point to 1649 and you can say, well, look, we chopped off a king's head. He wasn't obeying Magna Carta. Well, yeah, but, that was Parliament. So Parliament's gone wild, right?
Yeah.
And Parliament thinks it has plenary powers. They talk about there not being a Constitution of England, even though there is a Magna Carta. So I think it's going to take a long time to get this right. I think we have to have ways of imparting organizational knowledge, if you will, or memory from one generation to another to keep the process moving forward. Okay. And to know what works and to know what doesn't work, we're going to need a school of engineering to look into the technologies that work better, like open source machinery. We're going to have to look into the historical situations. We need a Department of History. We need some sort of alternative to the state for free market law. So we're going to have a law department. We're going to have all kinds of ways of addressing the different problems, because the tree of statism, or the tree of state supremacy, which is really what the statists are, they're state supremacists.
Mm-hmm.
It has all kinds of big branches, like protectionism, healthcare, prohibition, things like the minimum wage and other price controls, corporatism, control of the roads, control of the borders, mm-hmm. taxation, education, war, and, of course, money.
Yeah.
And at the root, down at the bottom, are the very fundamental things, the monopoly of power, the monopoly of force, especially as in the courts and in the police. They monopolize the provision of injustice, which is their word for justice system. And they monopolize force through the police and the military. And so all of these things are the state. And if we're going to repair these institutions or ditch them and get institutions that work, we're going to have to deal with each of these things. We're going to have to get into each of these areas. I think protectionism and minimum wage and corporatism, we can just throw that away because those are very high branches. And they're easily, obviously replaced by the free market. We don't need, monopolies. We need to have competition.
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody can compete in any area. But things like money, we're going to have to have provision for money. We have to have a provision for education. We have to have some sort of idea about how we're going to provide roads. I happen to have worked on roads in Texas and in Africa, and I've seen a lot of roads, and I've thought about this a long time, and you don't need a government to have roads. You need to have a real estate developer to have roads.
Right.
That's what you need. You need to have someone with a fucking ambition to pave some ground. That's where roads come from.
Yeah.
That's where most roads in Texas, in fact, have come from. It's just the local real estate developers have built the city streets because they wanted to sell the lots to really right. To house builders, mm-hmm. and the house builders would only build the lot if customers could get there. So you build a street, you know, and it's part of the plan. That's how you convert, you know, tens of thousands of dollars per acre of raw land into hundreds of thousands of dollars per quarter acre of houses.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and it happens all the time. It's very quick. So things like that, you know, people want health care. People want to have some sort of system of money or maybe competitive systems of money. People definitely want to have contracts enforced, and they want to have some system for dealing with crime. I think probably a compensatory system would be better. But people will work those things out. And so our mission is to provide a venue for anyone in the world to teach a course about any subject to anyone else who's willing to learn.
Right, and have
because
it framed
we have a lot
toward
of
this
to
have it framed toward this idea of educating a frame of agorist of agorism, because it's not just teaching engineering; it's specifically geared toward these ideas of the things that you're.
Well, that's
expressing
my that's my focus. Yes, absolutely,
yeah.
That is my focus, and that's what all of the people who were there in 2009 when we began talking about this in July. And talking about long-term institutions and talking about the need for this university, that's what everyone was into. But I don't know that that's always going to be the case. I think there are always going to be different courses that people will want. And, you know, if a war starts, people will want to learn how to make explosives. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't there be a way of securely logging into a site where someone who's expert in explosives can tell you how to do it without blowing your hand off?
Mm-hmm.
Is that particularly agorism? I don't know. But I don't want to control it. See, the difficult thing about this university project for me has been not to create a hierarchy, to not create a cult of personality,
mm-hmm.
to have it be what the people who show up want it to be. Because those are the people who matter, right?
Right.
You can talk all you want about your cause and about the importance of it, but the people who show up are the ones who actually do anything. And so I want it to be a very broad scope. I want to say anyone can teach a course in any subject for any reason to anyone else, and that by empowering people to choose to teach and to choose to learn whatever they want, I think we empower them to develop the tools for agorism and for any other sort of way of being. And I'm not down on agorism. I love it. I love the whole concept. I love the writings of Rothbard and of Konkin and even very early Shulman. And I think it is the path forward.
Yeah.
But what if I'm wrong? Or what if there are several paths? And why should we limit ourselves? And I think we should,
correct.
You know, I think we know that education is going to be one of those low-hanging branches where we really have to get a lot of work done. And so let's be as comprehensive as possible is
right.
my approach.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of how the university works? Like, pick one of your courses that you have right now. How does someone attend a course and or teach it? And is it in physical space? Is it online? And how do they pay?
Okay, so we've been doing a website, INDSOVU, so Individual Sovereign University. It's INDSOVU.com. We also own .org in case we need to do something different. On that site, there's a section, a heading at the top, a menu item in the top horizontal menu called the classroom. And underneath that are descriptions of the classes and then a checkout system. We're currently using Google Checkout. But any of our professors can offer a course on the forum and then accept payment in any way they want. We offer the Google Checkout, and if people want to stick with the university, we get a 5% fee. We don't put very much on it for ourselves, because all we're doing is maintaining a clearinghouse. But if people get together you know, through our system, and then say, well, you know, I don't like Google, I don't want to do credit cards, I don't want to do any of that shit. That's fine. They can just make a private arrangement and basically drop out of the university system and have their own educational experience between the professor and the student. And that's fine with me. I mean, I fully expect a lot of that to go on. So an example is my course in business planning.
Okay.
I taught a session at the Founding Fiesta earlier in March, which was basically a meet space gathering. I think we had 26 people in the room. And I went over the outline of a business plan, and I talked about the purpose of business plans and how you use them to raise money and what are the fundamentals to raising money and things like that. Because that's the kind of thing that I think people need to do to make the transition between where we are now and where we would like to be. A lot of people have money and would like to invest it in different things, and a lot of people have business ideas, and so that's the function of the business plan. So I also offer that online, and I'm currently teaching one student, mediating it through email. I send him email messages, and these are encrypted, because he happens to be someone who likes encryption. And so I send him the course assignments, and he does the work, and then I review it and say, okay, well, you know, these are the areas where we can improve. And so we've been doing that now since, I guess, January with different courses. And you can look at our site to get an idea of what the courses are. Obviously, there's a lot of holes in the course listings for, you know, an entire engineering department, for example, or an entire computer science department. And that's because, you know, the people who show up are the people who happen to be doing the work. And we're not wanting to create a hierarchy and do a bad job of creating courses in areas that we have no expertise. Mm-hmm. What we want are for the people to volunteer who really know their stuff and really see our mission as one that makes sense.
Yeah.
We'd also like to get rid of TikiWiki, frankly. I'm tired of it. We've tried to work with it for almost a year. We can't seem to customize it to do what we really want.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking for a way to completely revise and replace the website. You know,
what kind of stuff was it, the TikiWiki? What kind of stuff were you trying to do that wasn't working with you?
Really, I'm not on the web development team. My understanding is that a lot of the customization that we wanted wasn't possible. You know how people say, well, you can't do that. And, of course, you know, in some other software you can do it. And so we just had difficulty with it. And when we would go to the open source team that was developing it, we didn't get any kind of response to our interest in making our site a showcase for it. And, you know, this went on for months and months, and I think it's gone on too long. So if TikiWiki wants to be the software that makes our site look glorious, you know, and even if there's a cost to that, you know, we're fine with that. But it's not working for us now, and I'm looking for something that works. I would also like to expand our choices for checkout beyond the Google checkout concept, which is basically just credit cards and, you know, debit cards. And there is some anonymity available in the world to people who just, you know, walk into Walmart and get a Green Dot card and fill it. But the powers that be want to control all that, and, you know, there are so-called anonymous cards like that, but a lot of them want online registration, and then, you know, it's a mess. So instead of that, I'd like to add things like Pecunix and VoucherSafe and Bitcoin and
some of the Loom currencies.
Loom, the Global Settlement Foundation, Globals, and anything else really that works.
Yeah.
And ultimately, what I'd like to do is I'd like to back us out of the process. I'd like to have maybe a little tiny listing fee or something, and then the professor and the student get together, and if the student wants to hand over a silver coin, you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
And it's none of my business.
Yeah, that's great. I think that change that doing this multiple payment system, especially with all these new cryptocurrency and digital cash and asset transfer systems that are coming out like wildfire now, these things are opening up opportunities for people who would want to, in your example, teach a course as part of them exiting their current state-based or state-integrated systems. So this is a business opportunity for them, and they're more limited by that when they're dealing with credit card stuff. And then you start throwing in this other currencies, and then they can kind of jump into this outside of the sort of, it starts to turn more into a second realm university.
I would like that. I would really like that, and I'd like to see a lot more of that. Obviously, I worked with the people who were available, and we did what we could with the systems that they were familiar with, and this is where we are. But it's definitely my ambition to transition it to be as much in the second realm as possible.
Yeah, well, I think anonymous payments will do a lot for attracting teachers. I can see that.
I think that's probably true. I mean, I think anonymous payments will do a lot to attract everybody, because what everybody really wants is to avoid taxes and avoid regulations and avoid prohibition. Yeah. And what people really want is not to have the state in their business. Mm-hmm. They want to be able to do their business and be in their own business, but not have the state in there with them. And that's the trend that we've been seeing in a lot of areas where people don't want to go out to watch a movie. They want to rip it from BitTorrent. They want to download it from a Netflix type site. They want to stay home and have the media come to them. They don't want to go to a sex shop. They want to get their sex shop stuff on the web. They don't want to go to a porno theater, for God's sake, if you've ever been to one.
Yeah.
Sticky seats and sticky floors, and they don't want that. They want to stay home and have that stuff come to them. Gambling, they don't want to go to a casino. They want to stay home and have that stuff come to them. And in a lot of ways, the internet has been that that road to the consumer. And obviously, the state's very threatened by it. I like the fact that the 2006 Safe Harbors Act has generated this desire to shut down all the online gambling. Oh, evil online gambling,
Yeah.
And it's so funny because it paints the state as a complete hypocrite. I mean, the state has the state lottery, the state has the casino gambling where the IRS is basically in the cage with the cashier. And when you go to cash in your winnings, the IRS already has their one-third or whatever. It's so obviously hypocritical, and it makes the state look so stupid.
This past week, with the seizure of those poker companies' assets and their domain names and all the arrests, the responses that I saw on the different websites was just of that. It was just laughing. Everybody's initial response was this laughing at the hypocrisy.
Yeah, and it's also laughing at the idea that this is going to stop it. I mean, three poker sites? Are you shitting me? I mean, how many poker sites do you think there are? We could probably get Google to give us a list of hits on online poker. And my guess would be it's, millions of hits and probably thousands of sites, maybe tens of thousands of sites. I mean, how bloody hard is it to simulate a poker room? I don't know, but there's a lot of software out there that you can get, which just,
plug and play.
You add your bells and whistles on the outside, and it does all the work for you.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine that taking down three big poker sites is going to end online poker.
No.
And I don't know how the U.S. Justice Department imagines that that's what they're doing.
Well,
a show.
I think what they're doing is seizing funds. And this is what I've been hearing from some back channels about how they're operating in this gambling and the war on gambling, is that they really don't care about anything except nabbing high-level CEOs and directors and the like, and holding them basically for ransom, waiting for them to sign over hundreds of thousands, if not millions, $50 million, $100 million at a time. And once these guys sign over that money, many times they're instantly released. So that's one of the, if not the main reason.
This is an ancient tradition. We call it tax farming. You know, you send your soldiers out into the world, and they find the people who have money, and they hold them for ransom, and they take all of their stuff.
Right.
And
you know,
tax farming also works at the lower level of, you know, you send your soldiers out, and they find the food that the individual peasants are hiding, and they take the food. And this is what makes soldiers hated, and this is what brings about the end of systems.
Right.
You know, if you go back to Roman times, about 300, 400 AD, Rome was taking a third, and there were bureaucrats in every walled city in the Roman Empire, and the barbarians wanted 10%. So very often, the city gates would be open because, you know, not only would the barbarians come in and only want 10%, but they would also get rid of all the bureaucrats. They would be happy to kill the senator, and they might also kill a lot of virgins. So, you know, nice.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this the other day with the forfeiture laws that are out there for drugs and now with the, you know, casino operations and the like. It reminded me of what the governments used to do with these letters of marque, where they basically would give anyone that was going out the authority to seize anything, to initiate a war and to seize any of the goods on any ships that were, let's say they were called pirate, or they were of a particular flag. And so there, you had these people running around like we have now with the DEA and the like, where they are looking at the loot, you know, and they know if they can do this particular raid that they're going to walk away with, you know, they're going to, it's pillage. It's just outright pillage.
Yeah, and it's not just the DEA. It penetrates to the lowest levels of law enforcement, municipal police, sheriffs, and you know, the state police, the state highway patrol, all of the federal agencies. This is how roughly 13 million people in various branches of government at various levels and various agencies are trying to control a population in the United States of 300 million. And they do have the courts set up basically as admiralty prize courts, and they will sue your property as though it were an individual, but they will not sue it criminally. They'll sue it in a civil court context, and they will seize it, and they will take it away from you. This is this was the big game with Bernard von Nonhaus. This is why you know, they did the show trial to convict him. This is the concept behind a lot of these seizures. This is really one of the big things about Eagle. They wanted the gold. They didn't really give a shit about, you know, all of the things, all of the lies they told about Eagle, really. Mm-hmm. The government didn't really care about that. They wanted the loot. And this is part of the end of the state. You know, the state is no longer sticking to its guidelines and rules. It's broken free of all that. And it's no longer able to get people to create new businesses and, you know, pay into the tax system, because the tax system has become confiscatory and unfair, and it benefits people who are politically connected, so they don't have to pay, and everybody else is fucked, and everyone sees that. And so
yeah, that's key. Everyone's seeing this.
Huh?
I said that is one of the key points of what you just said, is that all that is happening, but people are seeing it now more than ever. Whereas before, the government had more of an air of legitimacy behind it, and now people are looking at it as completely, you don't even have a shred of legitimacy, and according to my basic moral framework, you're just completely out of line. And they may not even be coming from an agorist standpoint or libertarian or
right.
these types of claims.
There's two reasons for that, I think. One reason is that 20 years ago, in like 1989, 1990, we didn't have access to the information that we have now. There were still, in those days, civil asset forfeiture laws, and they were being used. And people were having their stuff taken away. But we didn't have the internet as a way. I mean, we had the internet. I mean, we all know that. You and I know that the internet goes back to 1969. But,
yeah.
You know, there was email and there were Usenet newsgroups and there were ways of outraging the guys in the computer center at the university. But nobody else in the university had a fucking computer
right,
on their desk.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that was the university, let alone the whole population. Nobody mm-hmm. knew how to get on the World Wide Web because there wasn't one. And now we have that. Now we have. I mean, I know the people in FEAR, the Forfeiture Endangers American Rights Organization. I know a lot of these people because I've met them over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been awake, you know, and active as an activist since about 1978 when I joined the Committee Against Registration in the Draft. I've seen the government being excessive and brutal and doing all of the things that Nixon did, but doing it in ways that people weren't complaining about, and it's been pissing me off for a long time.
Right.
And so that's one of the things is that people are more able to get the information about what's happening than ever before because of the new media, because of Second Realm media, and because you know, we just have all kinds of new social networking and ways of communicating.
Right, right.
And the second thing is that the state is starting to collapse. The state
yes.
is becoming increasingly rigid, and that's not a good thing. Because mechanical systems, complicated systems, need flexibility if they're going to survive.
Right.
They need to have a flexible response to things. And the state is calcifying. It's becoming more and more rigid. The people involved in the state are becoming more and more desperate. The people who are really smart are being attracted by the endless opportunities of Second Realm mm-hmm. to go do other things. And the state is getting the you know, stupider and stupider people are involved in the state.
Yeah.
And it won't last forever.
No.
But the problem, of course, is that they have nuclear weapons and they have a lot of anger issues. They really are brutal thugs. And when the state loses its legitimacy, that doesn't mean the state goes away.
Right.
You know, people in Egypt have proven that if the state loses its legitimacy, you can get it to go away if the army's on your side. But then you still have the army, right?
Yeah, and they in Egypt, a lot of people don't know this, but they passed an anti-protesting law just a few weeks ago. So,
yeah, because,
you know,
après moi. We got rid of Mubarak, but we're not going to have that happen to us. And Libya, I think, is the other example of what happens when a state that has had time to prepare and has had a paranoid outlook for a long time is challenged. You know, Libya is a bloody mess. And if you look at places like Lebanon or Afghanistan, which have had, or, you know, Vietnam from 1920 to 1980, you can have very, very long periods of time where everyone's at war and they haven't settled their conflicts, and they're not about to. And that's, you know, so that's not necessarily a good thing that the state is collapsing.
Yeah.
It will be replaced by something state-like, and that's not necessarily going to be better.
Right, right. Well, one of the things, it's one thing to have a system where you are crushing alternative currencies, or you're crushing alternate education and healthcare. And you have systems that are working at a general level. Your money system is working. At least it's accepted by most as being fine. That's one case. It's another thing when your institutions that you're trying to have as monopolize, they are themselves disintegrating. So you have people then running to use these alternate systems, and there's two things there. One is, if the main systems, if they collapse, is there an alternative that people can use at all, period? And then two,
right.
if it does take a long time to collapse, or another alternative does pop up, not alternative to the state, but the state replaces its old system with something new,
right,
where can people look and start to move into now? Now, I think one issue that slides right into this is the stuff that's happening with the finances with WikiLeaks and the stuff that's happening with the gambling. A lot of the banking institutions around the world that are processing the credit cards for these international gambling companies, and I'm not talking about the ones that were doing it with customers and banks inside the U.S. that just got busted, but a lot of the economic activity in these in the area of gambling, for example, has just moved outside the U.S. and has spurred an entire industry outside of the U.S. And we're seeing with the WikiLeaks getting their PayPal accounts frozen and then their Swiss bank account frozen. And the buzz in the Bitcoin community, which is, if you go on the Bitcoin forums, I'm telling you, they're on the Bitcoin official forums. If you go in there and scan around every couple of weeks, you will see a buzz in there about people talking about what is money and about the government and
all of
this stuff like I haven't seen before.
This is important. And this is important right now. This is happening right now, I believe, because of the monetary inflation that was put in place very suddenly in 2007, 2008, and has been continuing at a dramatic rate. And people are seeing that money is not what it used to be. And the long periods of stability where people don't talk about money are due to money being tied to something. Now, the period after World War II, from 1944 to about 1971, money was very stable. You knew what it was, $35 to the ounce of gold. And dollars are redeemable by foreigners, and if you have enough, you can go work a deal with a foreign bank. Monetary stability creates this kind of disinterest in what is money. And that's why the William Jennings Bryan conversation doesn't happen every 4 years during the election cycle. And so we're seeing that. The other thing is that you have to be careful about assuming that things are going to happen faster than they have in the past. We've had this situation before where there was a big empire called Rome, and one of the first things Emperor Augustus did after he took power is he began debasing the money. He began issuing less silver in the silver coins. And that went on for hundreds of years, right? I mean, Augustus is a contemporary of Jesus, so roughly 0 to 30 or so. And 400 AD, Rome is sacked. So, you get these long periods of time where they debase and they debase and they debase, and they can keep it going for a while. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that you have to be wary of is that the current system of free-floating currencies that's been in place since 1971 is not the ambition of the people who want to run things in the world. Their ambition is to get rid of nation-states and to have a one-world government and a one-world currency so that they can inflate forever. And their concept, which is completely mad, but their concept is that there would then be no place that is outside of the state.
Right.
And this is really important to them. If you read Rockefeller's papers, David Rockefeller's papers at the Council on Foreign Relations in the 30s and 40s, they understood this a long time ago. They began working on closing the frontiers. They closed Antarctica, the 1957 treaty. They wanted to close outer space to private development, and they did that with the 1967 treaty. They wanted to close the seas and the seabeds, and they did that with the 1982 Law of the Sea treaty. They want to close off these frontiers to make it impossible for you to be outside the system, because that is the obvious thing. You know, if you're outside the empire of the United States, then you can do your online gambling. Iceland, I think, is doing a great job of standing up to the bankers and saying, hey, bankers aren't going to get paid by our taxpayers because they fucked up. And I think that's a really good sign. I think a lot of little countries are going to be doing that. And different countries have stood up to the whole WikiLeaks thing and said, okay, you can in fact host information here, and we will in fact not shut down your server farm. So those are good things, but the world government people want to create a world where there is no place that you can go that's outside, because they know that that's where the barbarians will come from to destroy them. And they want to have that thousands of years of decadence. You know, they want to have the hydraulic empires of ancient Egypt, where there isn't enough outside to make it possible to overthrow the system.
Mm.
That's what they want. It's madness, and it goes against all of the other trends that we see.
Right,
you know,
right.
We don't see consolidation of countries. We see countries splitting up into smaller and smaller things. We had a consolidation of countries between 1917 and 1991 called the Soviet Union, right? And that's all broken up. That's all scattered to the winds. Even Russia itself can't keep peace in all of its provinces, like, you know, Chechnya comes to mind. And so I don't think this idea of a global empire has any merit. It's a completely
but that doesn't matter
idea.
If they may still, I mean, that may be their plan, and it may just be a lot of blood between now and the time that it doesn't work out.
Exactly, and this is one of the reasons why we think a university is a good idea, because there's going to be a period of transition, and it may be a few years, and it may be a few decades, and it may be a few centuries, and we don't know how long it will be, but we know that it has taken a long time to get to where we are, and we're still not where we want to be. So one of the other things about universities that has been true over time is that they have become centers of withdrawal. People go to the university to avoid the draft. They go to the university to avoid having to go into the military. They go to the university to avoid having to work. And the university creates an artificial environment, you know, often with like a boundary. There's a campus, and on the outside of the campus there are research labs for industry, and then beyond that there's a town. And that model is, I think, a good one for the long-term survival of knowledge, because people do need to have a place to get away. They do need to have a relief from the concept of the 9-to-5 grind. And they need to be able, frankly, to think their way out of some of these problems
right.
that seem to be everywhere and entrenched. And I think that's, you know, that's another motivation in creating the university.
Well, that's great. You know, you mentioned something about the Sea Act in the 60s or such. Are you following anything that Patry Friedman is working on with his seasteading project?
Well, I've been following Patry's work since, I think, I believe it was July of 2004 when he came to Freedom Fest in Las Vegas and first made his presentation about seasteading.
Uh-huh.
And I was there in the room when he did that, and I, you know, and I'm a big admirer of his father, David Friedman, and I think he's got a lot of really good ideas on the ball. But the 1982 Law of the Sea Treaty makes it very difficult to set up an artificial platform and declare your own country. It deliberately makes it very difficult to recover land from the sea by, like, doing what Mike Oliver did in 1972 with Minerva. Basically just dredging up sand and piling it on top of a seamount in the South Pacific
uh-huh.
until he had a country. I mean, and you know, Mike Oliver did a lot of work on this, put in place a navigational beacon and emergency equipment, because New Zealand then would recognize his country. New Zealand was pissed off about this long-standing navigational hazard on their main shipping routes, and if someone would do what he was doing, they were happy to recognize his country. So, you know, Minerva was actually recognized by New Zealand, which is a country people, you know, have heard of. And so the CIA convinced Tonga to go and conquer it, which indeed happened. 6 war canoes full of thugs came and wrecked everything and
really?
Claimed the land for Tonga.
In canoes?
War canoes, yeah. I guess these are Polynesian canoes of some significance. They paddled 400 nautical miles. They probably did some sailing, too. But, yeah, they went a long fucking way to conquer Minerva. Because this is important to the people in power. This is, you know, this is why we have three wars going on right now for the United States. You can't have a major espionage agency unless there's a global threat to freedom.
Right.
Right? And it used to be, you know, for a long time, 1917 to 1991, it was the Russians, you know. You can blame everything on the Russians. They were the problem with everything. And they were, you know, the Red Menace, the Red Scare. It turns out that when the CIA briefed John F. Kennedy in 1960 and told him about the missile gap, that there were 500 nuclear-tipped Russian missiles pointed at American cities, there were, in fact, at the time, six. And they didn't brief Nixon on this because Nixon was in the White House as vice president, knew it was all bullshit. So the missile gap controversy in 1960 was one of these games that the espionage agency played to create the impression that there was a global threat to freedom and that they were necessary, that you had to have, you know, a big central intelligence agency. This has been their wet dream. And this pissed them off. For 10 years after 1991, it was really hard to get a good war going, right? Because the Soviet Union's gone, and where are we going to find a threat?
Yeah.
You know? And the global Islamic fascist conspiracy, which is, of course, as you know, bullshit, is their current concept, you know, Islamo-fascist. I understand that earlier this week, 460, some large number of Taliban prisoners were given keys to their prison cells and tunneled their way out 1,500 feet or something, or maybe 1,500 yards, out of a prison in Afghanistan. Now, why did this happen, and where did they get the keys from? And I'm just thinking, well, God, the CIA must have given them copies of the keys because they're running out of war in Afghanistan, and if they get these guys out of prison and back into the field, more American soldiers will be killed, which is sad. But happily, there will be more, you know, Afghanistan resistance, and there will be endless war for endless profit.
Where was this prison at?
Somewhere in Afghanistan. You can look it up on the web. 400-plus Taliban fighters tunneled out of their prison. I think the tunnel was actually brought in from outsiders, and the guys in the prison say that friends gave them keys. And, you know, who are these friends?
Yeah, right. Who's the benefit
so,
of this?
You know, it's exciting. We live in exciting times, and we've come to the attention of important persons.
Hey, I have a question on this thing with Empire, on what you think about what's happening with the dollar. And there's been some discussions, and I know that you and I have been in some of the discussions on the gold, silver.
Let's just go to Kitco and have a look at what's happening to the dollar today.
Go ahead. Yeah, on the gold, silver, crypto list, we had a couple of discussions on the collapse of the people talking about the dollar and the financial problem, and they talk about the collapse of the U.S. And one point I brought up is that there's two types of collapses that can be identified, and one is the collapse of empire, where they run out of funding because the dollar's just not kicking it anymore, and they just cannot afford to have 1,000 military bases throughout the world. So the empire could collapse, and then all of that military might, all of those soldiers, all the weaponry, all this stuff, it just gets taken back home. And that's a separate type of a collapse. That's more of a collapse of the U.S. empire rather than the collapse of the U.S. itself. And let's just say that happened at one level. I mean, you gave the example of these, you know, spy versus spy CIA guys and other people going around the world and causing problems to create situations that they can get more funding to fight. And like, if they lose their funding and they just don't have the money and the only thing they can do is just focus on their own territory, it seems to me like the collapse of the U.S. empire would open up many realms of opportunity throughout the world for a lot of things that can't be done, not because necessarily certain countries around the world don't would have a problem with them. It's that the U.S. government will not let them do it. I mean, we talk about in the past the one-world government, and as far as I can see right now, there is a one-world government in many ways, and that's the U.S. government.
Well, I think that the U.S. government is basically very obedient. I think Congress has been militarized. I think Congress obeys the military. I think the system that people talk about of a republic is certainly broken, and there's no evidence of it anymore. It's very easy to penetrate the illusion that there's still a republic. But I don't know that that's necessarily who's really running things. I think if you get further upstream from people like Obama and Bush and Clinton, you find that there are other people pulling the strings, and they're not entirely puppets, because they do have office and they do exert some of their own power. But there are other people pulling the strings, and I think, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations is very influential. It's run by the Rockefellers, and David Rockefeller, even though he's a very old man, has been very influential for a long time. So, you know, I do think there is an ambition by some of these crazy people to impose a one-world government. And, you know, obviously one of the ideas is that inflation of the dollar has worked so well to finance all these wars and to create trillions of dollars of pretend wealth. And why not just have a one-world currency and have, you know, gazillions of dollars of, you know, not dollars, but they'll be, you know, bank ore or whatever they want to call the world currency. And so I think their ambition is the same. You have a central bank that provides the actual funding, and the taxation is used to take from the people who are capable of making money, take it away from them, and give it to the people who are parasites, the bureaucrats who, you know, manage things and tell people what they're supposed to do. Supposedly, because they're, you know, educated and enlightened, and everyone else is, you know, dumb. I don't think it's a model that works very well, but that is what they want, right? I mean, and that's why they're so outraged when a challenge like Bradley Manning comes to their system. You know, this is an ordinary soldier with, I guess, what, roughly a specialist class rank, and he's smuggling information out, apparently, on Lady Gaga CDs.
Yeah.
Or at least he's put a CD in a Lady Gaga case, and, you know, he's sitting there pulling hundreds of thousands or millions of documents off their system and turning it over to WikiLeaks, allegedly. You know, the president says he broke the law. The president of the United States has decided to rule by decree, and we're not going to have, you know, trials anymore. The president says he broke the law, therefore he has to be punished. Which is interesting because the president doesn't have the authority under the Constitution to make a finding of guilt or innocence. The president is supposed to wait for the judiciary to do that. But, you know, this is another sign of a crumbling empire. You know, they've moved him to Leavenworth. I'm actually going to be at a rally in the early part of June in Leavenworth, Kansas, to talk about these issues, to talk about what kind of a government the U.S. military represents. And I don't think it really represents the republic of the Constitution that people, you know, are familiar with. I think it represents something much more nefarious and darker and more sinister and run by people who are behind the scenes and therefore are much harder to kill. You know, you can always kill the king because you go to the place where he has the throne, you find him, you chop his head off. That's what they did at Charles I. It worked really well. I think they did that in France to some Louis the 16th. Mm-hmm. You could look that shit up. But, you know, the problem with the spider at the center of the web in this case is that, you know, they have the ambition to rule the world, but they're not wanting to be exposed to the light of scrutiny. And so it's much harder. I mean, what if David Rockefeller has a Bitcoin account? What do you do then? What if all these people just, you know, submerge themselves into the Second Realm and have their own money and convert it into Second Realm money? And they still have the nefarious purpose of controlling everyone else and sending their armies out to rape and pillage and slaughter. You know, how do you prevent that? How does that work? Is it necessarily a good thing that anonymous money is being provided by the hacker culture to people who might not necessarily have our enlightened purposes in mind? I don't know. I mean, we're obviously going to find out.
Well, they are. The thing is,
stop the signal, man.
I mean, right, exactly. But I mean, the one way to look at that is that they, through their own structures and financial empires, they already have their own anonymous money by the way that they move things around and do it. One of the things that Orland Graeby talked about in some of his articles was exposing the bankers as the money launderers themselves, and the government being involved with them, and that the one of the goals of the DMT system was to give people to implement an option for an honest money system for people, so an individual on the street can have the same security and privacy of their wealth that only the super rich could afford. So these guys kind of already do have their anonymous digital cash.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, you know?
No, you're right. And there's a lot of truth to that. And what Orland was saying is correct. And what we need are alternative, not only alternative money, but we also need to move it up to the next level and have alternative stock markets, alternative bond markets, alternative ways of investing in these other deals that we think are coming down the path, like open source automobiles. I'm just mad for that. I love that idea. And I think there's all kinds of ways that setting up stock markets in the second realm will happen. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You weren't finished. Go ahead.
Oh, just that if one of the ideas with the digital cash and cyber currency, cryptocurrency and the like, is that when you have this, one of the reasons why they have a lot of the power that they have, when I say they, I'm talking about people in the state and the financing that the CIA and the military machines. They don't have parts of their army just outrunning gold mines. They're taking their money from other people, and the people that are using, so they have a monopoly on this money system. So the more that people can have their wealth and their personal property protected in these alternate systems, the less that they have to confiscate. And that gets back to a lot of the goals behind the agorist type activity. So, I mean, you talk about open source automobiles. I mean, these 3D printers that are starting to pop out, just amazing stuff lately. You know, you could say, well, do we want the military to have some of these, you know, nano
printers? The military has actually been working on them, and they don't work for shit with metal. My brother, Tom, lives in Boston area and works for Z Corp, which is one of the 3D printer companies. And the stuff works really well with the plastics. It makes a really good rapid prototyping system. You can change your design and print out another, you know, handheld device and really get an idea of what it looks like and how it feels. But if you want to go to metal, you're talking about centering. You take a powder of aluminum and you use the laser to center that metal, and it does not give you the strength of material that you will get from forging or from stamping. Mm-hmm. And it works even less well with steel. And it's not as easy as it seems. We're really not yet at the nanotechnology level where we have assemblers to put the molecules together. That's coming, but that's not here yet. And I think it's a mistake to think that you're going to print out a car.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I'm just
print
using
out
that
the
as
hologram
a...
of a car. You can print out the image of a car in three dimensions, but it's not going to... The centering of the metal is not going to hold together. It just doesn't work.
Right, but that's with current technology. I'm just using the analogy of some type of a technology that, you know, do we want to have this technology that could get into the hands of some bad people, and because of that, we would want to or think it might be better that individuals don't have this technology to you know, to run their own power, you know, to have their own.
Well, the rapid prototyping systems are used by the military contractors to design weapon systems, and the Navy wants to put big printers and have big sacks of powdered metal and be able to go to sea in an aircraft carrier without all the spare parts. You know how many spare parts an aircraft carrier has to carry? All of those bolts and all of those rivets and all of those, you know, drive shafts and complicated bits, they have to carry spares of all that. And they would much rather, you know, have that all just be bulk powder and a printer. It would make their lives a lot easier. So they're paying for a lot of this research. They're paying, and, you know, the governments are paying for a lot of the nanotechnology research. And I guess the answer is, you know, Pandora's box is open and everyone gets to play. You know, we don't get the choice of who gets to use the technology. We didn't actually, you and I didn't sit down in 1969 and think up how we could overthrow the system. I don't even know if you were alive then. I was a very young child. But, you know, they did this internet thing by accident. They designed a system that could survive a nuclear war that was robust and distributed, and here we are.
Yeah.
I don't think they really had in mind creating the tools for us to overthrow their centralized systems.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, they did the crypto for protecting their codes.
Open source crypto came about shortly after that, right. Mm-hmm. Open source crypto developed because it became obvious that keeping the secret of how the code works was more dangerous than publishing the code, because the mathematicians could take it apart and make a stronger code. And that led to open source software, and that's brought us more or less to where we are today.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And that's why decentralization is such a great thing. It's the model that we're pushing for agorism, mm-hmm. is to not have a central electric power system, but have local individual ability to produce electricity from all kinds of things, wind, solar, diesel generators, what have you. And centralization doesn't work. The nice thing about decentralization is that we get rid of bureaucracies. We don't need them anymore. We get rid of a lot of the price controls. We don't need a monopoly power utility. We can individually produce our power.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a lot of merit to decentralization. That's the open source automobile again. You know, we don't need to have a big factory in Detroit to build our automobiles. We can have probably a factory in a tractor trailer rig that takes materials in at one end and spits out more or less finished parts to be assembled into automobiles at the other.
Yeah,
and so you get 10 customers in a city who want cars of the same design. You send the tractor trailer rig to that city. It hooks up to three-phase power, pumps out the 10 cars, delivers them to the other assembled there on site, delivered, and so you no longer have a factory. It used to be that the unions and the government would come and make the factory a target because it couldn't run away.
Right,
and
right,
guess
right.
What?
Yeah.
Now we have factories probably, if not right now, then within the next few years, we have factories that can run away.
Right, right.
And that's hot. And that's a huge development. Right,
it
there.
Is. And the agora.io conference in the Patrick Friedman's presentation, one of his points was this idea of, instead of looking to change things from the top down and try to create systems that have more freedom, his idea is this idea of structural freedom from the bottom up. And a lot of agorist ideas are like that. And what we're talking about here is that if you look at like you said, the merits of decentralization, they take care of so much stuff. When you can decentralize down to a local level, all those layers that build up to these massive bureaucracies that these parasites sink their teeth into so hard, they just kind of wither and fall away. And if you have, like, the whole oil thing right now, and the way that it's subsidized by the military and the government, you know, you start having a local based power, then that bastion that they were holding on to in order to demand and force people all the way down to just go ahead because you have no other choice. And the same thing for power, for you gave the automobile.
Right.
I know there's a lot of agorist farming going on to like help sidestep this whole massive government subsidized I don't know what you call farming.
Can we jump back over to seasteading for just a second? Because I have a criticism, and this has actually been a fairly long-standing criticism since I was working with Eric Klein back in 1994 on what he called the Atlantis Project to create a country. The criticism is that you can get rid of one of these platforms with a single submarine and a couple of torpedoes. And the people in governments have a lot of submarines, and they have a shit pile of torpedoes. A lot of offshore platforms have been taken in wartime as bases of operation to then project power further in. And, you know, I think it was like one team of SAS in a Zodiac took out Sealand and burned it to the waterline not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to ask yourself the question, if we're going for decentralization, we're going to distribute ourselves and have, take ourselves apart from the state and have all this freedom from the ground up, is the ocean surface really where you want to be? If you could get under the ocean and if you could get into some of the underwater mountain ranges, you know, there's clearly a lot of geography down there where you could hide out. But I'm not sure you can deal with the pressures yet.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, there's you double every time you go down 32 feet, so not a good thing. So I'm more of a fan of mountains. You know, I'm more a fan of places like Montana and Nevada, which are empty. And if you think those are empty, look at Alberta and British Columbia. Mountains give you ruggedness. You can hide from satellites. You can do a lot more without being visible. And the surface of the ocean, it's very hard to hide from satellites. It's very hard to hide from submarines. And it's very hard to hide from aircraft. And they've got a lot of those things right now, and we don't. So I would encourage people to think about mountain steading.
Huh. Interesting term.
I just coined it.
Yeah. It's nice. I like it. You can start up the Mountain Steading Institute.
Well, you're welcome to do that. I did it on your show, so you know you can claim as much of it as you want. This intellectual property concept doesn't really work for me.
Are you going to be heading out to Porkfest this year?
You know, I've thought about that, and I've reconsidered it several times, and I'm currently thinking that I will go out there for a couple of days and help get things started and then disappear. Yeah. I've had a lot of issues with the Porkfest organizers over the years, issues having to do with personalities and cliquishness, and I really appreciate the work they do, and I really appreciate the people who come together there. And I want Individual Sovereign University to have a tent and get involved in the festivities. But I'm not sure if I'm personally going to feel welcome there and want to hang around.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we will see. I've got this thing in Leavenworth, Kansas in early June, and the other June project is Porkfest. And I do have a team that wants to go out there and be there. I've got a bunch of our Northeast contingent, like Justin Robertson and Stacy Litz, who want to be there.
Great.
So we will have some people there. I just don't know how much of my time I'm going to spend there.
Yeah. Well, for the listeners, there's you post on a semi-regular basis articles on the net, and this is at the what is the name? The Libertarian Enterprise? What is that called?
Well, that's one of the places where I write, yeah. The Libertarian Enterprise was founded in 1995 by author L. Neil Smith, and he writes about every week, and it's ncc-1776.org, which is a Star Trek joke. You know, NCC is the code for all of their ships, and then 1776 for Liberty.
Right.
And
yeah.
So you get the Starship Enterprise and the Libertarian Enterprise, and I don't know. It's not mnemonic, but whatever.
Yeah.
So that's one of the places, ncc-1776.org, and then another place where I blog is at indsovu, indsovu.com, and I also frequently snipe and kibitz on the gold, silver, crypto list, which is that still at Ray Servers?
Yes.
We've moved it. You know, it used to be the eGold talk list. It was talk.eGold, and then it became DGC chat at Gold Money, and then Ray came up with Gold Silver Crypto a few years ago. And that's so I do a lot of commentary there. And I also have a Facebook account as Planetary Jim.
Right. I'll throw these links up on the for the show notes.
If you like, yeah. Yeah, my Facebook account has a lot of notes and is currently infested with a lot of liberal anti-war activists who are talking about the Bradley Manning situation. And that's turning out pretty well. We've already got over 400 people committed to show up, and we've only been talking about it for now a week. Today it's a week. So we have like 5 more weeks before the event. And I think we might get a few thousand.
What is your?
Our ambition is to get 100,000.
100,000 people to show up.
Yeah, oh. Sure. 100,000 people. We could surround the base, join arms, sing kumbaya, and scare the hell out of them.
Yeah. Are you working with Mike Ogulski on this at all?
I am, yeah. Mike Ogulski, the BradleyManning.org people, the Courage to Resist people. We're working with Veterans for Peace. We're working with Ann Pritchett and her people. We're working with some of these people who are, I guess, going to Gaza right now. And I've heard a rumor that Dan Ellsberg is planning to speak. You know, Daniel Ellsberg was the Pentagon Papers guy.
Right,
who,
yeah.
Brought down the Nixon administration, and he's been working on Obama, and I guess got beat up at Quantico in March by the police thugs there. And we've invited Member of Congress Dennis Kucinich and Member of Congress Ron Paul to speak. I haven't heard from their people yet, but Kucinich is... spoken several times about how the rule of law is you know, encompassed in Bradley Manning's case, and how, you know, the treatment of him is appalling, and we need to keep remembering, you know, the limits to government, and you know, that's impressive stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw Ron Paul on Stephen Colbert last night, but Ron Paul was talking about the money issue and how. Half of Congress is a welfare state outfit that wants money to be printed up to throw at the welfare state, and the other half of Congress is militaristic and wants to have money printed up for the military, and they pretend to fight each other, but they're really always capitulating to get both.
Right.
And
yeah, and both sides use the other side to make deals. To get the money that
they
want.
Yeah, exactly.
Want, you know?
And it's it reminds me a lot of the big Indians and the little Indians, the guys with which side of the egg do you open first in Gulliver's Travels, you know. Jonathan Swift talked about this whole. And they all have their, you know, they all have their network of flappers, the people whose ears who keep their ears closed unless you convince the assistant to open the ear of the person who's important. And it's just brilliant, brilliant stuff. It's been going on a long time. If you can read Gulliver's Travels and see all of the current characters and problems in it, or if you can read the Tao Te Ching and see how all of these things, you know, the lust for power really grabs some of these people and makes them into monsters.
Yeah.
And it's a very trenchant problem. I like the idea that our technologies are going to make it possible to escape from the plantation and not have the overseers beat the shit out of us anymore.
Yeah.
I really like that idea. I'm not confident that it's true, but I think there's going to be a window here. After the collapse of the states, after the United States stops being what it has been as an empire in the world, there's going to be a short window of 10 or 20 years, much like the period after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And there's going to be a sea change. There's going to be a short window of opportunity, and I want to use that to go to Mars. You can all go to hell, as Davy Crockett once said. You can all go to hell. I'm going to Mars.
Because well,
I think until we're distributed as a species around the solar system, until we're distributed yeah. around the galaxy, there's always going to be this lust for control. And even then, there's going to be a lust for control, but it'll be harder to avoid the fact that there's an outside, that there are,
yeah.
there are right. barbarians beyond the gates.
Yeah. Right, because they have to close off the frontiers. And once you're out in the space, I mean, it's not like just closing off the sea.
It's a frontier in every direction, right?
Yeah.
It's
and once you have the technology to go out of the solar system.
Up or down, left or right, forward
yeah, right.
or back.
Right.
And really, you don't have to go outside the solar system. You have to get out to the asteroid belts, because once you get out to the asteroid belts, you have this enormous resource base. Once you're in Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere in the solar system, and that includes the Kuiper Belt, the Oort cloud, the cometary halo. Once you're out into those resources, and that's a huge resource base compared to, say, a planet like Jupiter, it's an enormous volume of space, too. It's about 2 light-years of this cometary halo surrounding our sun. And guess what? 4 light-years away is another sun, and if it has a 2 light-year Oort cloud around it, Alpha Centauri, well, then you're just, you've gone out halfway, and you just hop to the next Oort cloud, and then you go in. Your distances become much more manageable once you're dealing with asteroidal and cometary-based resources. You're talking about very small delta V. I mean, yes, the light years are still there. But in terms of the change in velocity that you need, the amount of energy you have to expend here to get over there becomes much less. And so that's, I think, the long-term future of human civilization is out in space, mm-hmm. and that it won't be planetary ecologies. That once you get out of the gravity well, the last thing you fucking want to do is go back down into another gravity well.
Uh-huh.
You don't need a planet to have simulated gravity. You just rotate your spacecraft and you get centripetal force,
right.
and that provides simulated gravity. So you can have any level of gravity you want at that point. So why go all the way down into a gravity well?
Right, right.
Gravity wells are for old-fashioned people who don't understand that technological civilization doesn't want to be down there. It wants to be out where there's cheap vacuum and cheap zero gravity, things that are really useful for a lot of chemical and industrial processes.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see that as long-term, planetary things.
Well,
but Mars has the advantage right now of being easily settled because it's got an atmosphere. And I'm always going for the easy, the low-hanging fruit.
Right, right. And go from there. Well, this sounds like we could do another show. I would like to hear about your space program that the government crushed when you were just starting to get off the ground. Not now, but on another show. Hopefully we can have you back.
Yeah,
and then and how you see the things that are going on that what's the Virgin guys doing with the space project and some of these privatization
Yeah,
scams.
We should definitely talk about some of that, because I have been an observer of that industry for a long time, and I definitely have things to say about it.
Yeah.
And, and there are other topics we can talk about, so I really look forward to doing another show maybe next week.
Hey, well, that sounds great. We went over a little bit today, but it's been fascinating and well worth it. We're going to take off now. Jim, thank you very much for coming on the show, and we'll have you back soon.
Well, thank you, Hiro. It's really delightful to talk to you.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. That's been a fascinating little talk. We kind of bounced around there, but on good topics, and we'll have Jim back again soon. Thanks for listening, and we're going to close out here with The Crystal Method. And the song is Weapons of Mass Distortion.
dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.